listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Whether you're a jazz aficionado or just jazz curious, Montevilla Jazz Festival 22 has something for you in the vibrant sounds of local musicians. Friday, August 19th through Sunday, August 21st. Portland artists will be performing across the city. They will include Harry Politzer, Marilyn Keller, Rebecca Sanborn, and Daryl Grant. During the festival, you'll hear the story of the Columbia River, traditional rhythms of Zimbabwean fusion and improvisations. More information can be found at montevillajazz.org.
San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, while Politico reports that the FBI warrant shows Trump under investigation for potential obstruction of justice and Espionage Act violations, some are cautioning that the act has a long history of abuse. Not a good idea, maybe. Also, did the U.S. plot to assassinate Julian Assange? A Spanish judge is demanding some answers from former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And we continue our drumbeat coverage of the UFW's 335-mile pilgrimage to Sacramento for the right to organize like other unions. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. I believe we're kicking off with Kevin Camps. Are you there, Kevin? Oh, okay. All right. We are trying to make contact. We're having a little bit of a technical screw-up with the phone numbers. Let me say that later on in the broadcast, we will... bring you a piece from the march. We have some beautiful interviews from people. Today they walked some 22, 23 miles. Can you believe that? In 100 degree plus weather for a good part of the time. So we've got some beautiful interviews from the walk and some local politicians who've come out to support the walkers. So again, you might want to tune in to that just a little bit later on in this hour. And let's do this. Shall we take a musical break and come back and see if we can dig up our guest? How about that? Batman, Batman. back those technological demons. We'll beat them yet. And this is Dennis Bernstein. The show is Flashpoints. Joining us now, we're happy to have him, is Kevin Camps, anti-nuclear expert. He works with a wonderful organization called Beyond Nuclear. Kevin Camps, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
These are becoming extremely dangerous times. Could you update us in terms of your analysis and your understanding of what the situation is happening around those floating nuclear weapons in Ukraine?
Well, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, is that what you're asking about?
Yes, please. I'm saying
yes.
Yeah, because they're out there in the middle of a war zone. But yes, that's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, so in southern Ukraine is the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. It's called Zaporizhzhia, after the city. It's 6 full-scale atomic reactors. The Russian military attacked it and seized it in early March, in the early days of this war, and they've occupied it ever since. And over the past several weeks, the situation has just grown much more dire. The Russian military has stationed some heavy artillery pieces there. They've parked them between the reactor units. There's reports of just horrible mistreatment of the Ukrainian nuclear power plant staff, including things like electroshock torture. Apparently, the Russian military is trying to find, people who are helping the Ukrainian war effort against the Russians on the staff itself. So there's something like 10 workers who are simply missing. No one knows where they are after more than 100 abductions. But the shelling is the most disconcerting thing. It's hard for me to understand why the Ukrainian side would shell its own nuclear power plant. Although that being said, the Ukrainian side has admitted to using a precision kamikaze drone to take out a rocket launcher at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant that the Russians had installed there. But in terms of just random shelling, that would be suicide for the Ukrainians to do that, because Zelensky had it right in early March when the Russian military first seized Zaporizhzhia. There's the potential for 6 Chernobyls. That just refers to the reactors themselves. And then if you look at the high-level radioactive waste storage pool, you're now talking easily dozens of Chernobyls that could be unleashed from that plant in a worst-case scenario.
Wow. Now, let's go over this again. Did you say that the Ukrainians actually fired on the plant where the Russians had taken up positions?
No, quite to the contrary. The Ukrainians have almost entirely withheld fire, because if they inadvertently hit one of the reactor units or one of the storage pools for high-level radioactive waste, that could unleash a Chernobyl-scale catastrophe. The Ukrainians know better than anybody what a Chernobyl-scale catastrophe in their country means, because they've lived through it since 1986. I don't think they would do that. What they do admit to is using a precision kamikaze drone to take out a rocket launcher on the site. But that's only one of many heavy artillery pieces that the Russian military has installed there.
Wow. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And again, say a little bit more about what that means, because people somehow have been sold to this day, as you know, on the peaceful atom. How could a nuclear reactor be turned into a nuclear weapon in this context? How does that happen?
Well, it would kind of take the form of a dirty bomb of immense proportions. You have so much radioactivity at an atomic reactor, even in so-called Atoms for Peace electricity generating station. You've got the fuel in the core. That would be a reactor meltdown. You've got the fuel in the high-level radioactive waste storage pools. So it's just in terms of how much radioactive fallout could escape into the environment, to fall out on the land, to contaminate the water, to contaminate the air. So those are the risks. And I should mention that the Russian military is not sitting idly by at this plant. They're actively firing their heavy artillery at nearby Ukrainian positions. So, there were warnings, including a book in the mid-1980s by Bennett Ramberg called Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy. And the main point was, if you have nuclear power plants, in your domestic territory, your enemy in warfare could target them to cause these dirty bomb effects of gigantic proportions. So that was an academic warning. Well, now we're living it in full-scale warfare. This is the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, very close to the front lines of a full-scale war.
Thank you. Well, you know, that's really troubling in the age of Trump and beyond, where violence is clearly a part of the new Republican Party. Should we worry that some of these former U.S. soldiers now turned Trumpistas? What's stopping them from moving into a plant or holding a city hostage by taking a nuclear plant? Is that of concern?
Yeah, definitely. Whether it's domestic terrorism or foreign terrorism here in the United States. So, for example, on the 9/11 attacks, Al-Qaeda contemplated attacking the Indian Point nuclear power plant near New York City. In fact, the lead hijacker, Muhammad Atta, asked permission from his superiors in Al-Qaeda to attack Indian Point. He had noticed it during his training flights down the Hudson River, and he was denied permission to do so, so they reverted to attacking the World Trade Centers. And before he was captured by the United States and Pakistan, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed told an Al Jazeera interviewer that the reason that they did not attack nuclear power plants on September 11th was they did not want things to get out of hand. So we were relying on the moral restraint of Al-Qaeda at that point. To bring it fast forward to recent years, there is documentation of a domestic terrorist group called Atomwaffen Division. Atomwaffen means nuclear weapon in German. It's a relatively small but extreme radical white supremacist and neo-Nazi group in the United States. And in fact, two of their members attempted, it seems, to attack a nuclear power plant in Florida called Turkey Point. They were en route in their car, which was filled with weapons and ammunition. And by a complete fluke, they were apprehended by police en route. So they didn't make it. And granted, it was only two individuals, but it is very much a concern. These are sitting duck facilities. Their security would be a joke if it weren't so serious in many instances. So yeah, it's a real problem.
It's a real problem. Okay, let's bring Harvey Wasserman back into this. Welcome back, Harvey Wasserman. We put this now in the context of what's happening here in California, in which apparently a governor, a liberal, so-called progressive governor, has lost his mind and is willing to spend, what, $1.6 billion on trying to save a reactor that could take away a good chunk of the California coast?
Well, you know, Gavin Newsom, who wants to be president apparently, is the first major governor to simultaneously fight against solar energy while promoting nuclear energy. This is new ground he's breaking here, because there are regulations now in front of the California Public Utilities Commission that would gut the very large rooftop solar industry in California. You know, Dennis, in California now we have 70,000 people working in wind and solar and 1,500 at Diablo Canyon. And the Diablo Canyon nuclear plants are uninsured. They're basically uninspected. At least Unit 1 is severely brittled. It's under-maintained because certainly, well, PG&E has never been known for its concerns for safety. But since the deal was cut to shut those reactors in 2018, PG&E has been probably doing no real maintenance. The reactors are in violation of California environmental law in terms of their cooling system, which is now destroying the marine environment off the coast at Avila Beach, west of San Luis Obispo. And here our wonderful liberal governor is, saying that he wants to operate Diablo Canyon for years to come, even though it loses $3.5 million a day. The power coming out of Diablo Canyon is so far over market that it costs another $1 billion a year just to keep it operating, despite the market. And now he wants to give $1.5 billion taxpayer dollars to Diablo Canyon. It's absolutely insane.
And what's your take on the driving force behind the governor? Why do you think he would take a risk, Kevin Kemp? Could he be so stupid, or is this just like a political decision that it might gather more folks to support him if he perpetrates this lie about the peaceful Adam? What's the deal?
Well, we have a similar situation here in Michigan with the Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer trying to resurrect a permanently closed reactor at Palisades. It closed on May 20th. And their insane schemes, unfortunately, now have a lot of money available to put them into reality. This Inflation Reduction Act at the federal level contains around $73 billion, with a B, for old reactor bailouts in this country. And the top candidates are Diablo Unit 1, Diablo Unit 2, and Palisades in Michigan. It's because of, you know, Gavin Newsom and Gretchen Whitmer probably have the energy secretary's phone number on speed dial. But to answer your question, I think it's a reflection of the political and economic power of the nuclear power industry in this country. Just to make it more baffling, in Gavin Newsom's case, he was at the table and helped to orchestrate the deal to shut Diablo in 2024 and 2025. Now he's doing a complete reversal of his previous position. You know, they should have been shut years ago, decades ago. 2024 and 2025 shutdowns were a compromise and still very high risk. And now that's all out the window. It's totally insane.
And so what is the remedy, Harvey? It seems like the governor is unreachable on this one. He seems hell-bent on going forward. Is he being driven by big funders, by his potential for raising money based on this kind of decision? What do you think's at the core here?
Well, you got it right. There's big money, and the point is that the fossil nuclear industry, what Kevin and I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, are at the brink here. Everybody in the energy industry knows that rooftop solar will kill the utility industry entirely. This is a technological moment of profound change where the public can control its own energy supply. And over the past few years, we've seen, you know, time after time after time, the deliberate sabotage of the solar energy industry. But, you know, every rooftop in California could have solar panels that would be extremely cost effective and that would end the grip of Southern California Edison, Pacific Gas and Electric, all the other big utility companies who are obsolete and they're dinosaurs. And in order to preserve the future business of these utility companies, they need to keep us reliant on nuclear power and fossil fuels.
Thank you.
Which are killing small detail. So, you know, our survival as a democracy and as a species depends on shutting these atomic reactors, getting off of fossil fuels, and converting to renewable energy. And that's what terrifies the fossil nuclear industry that's supporting Gavin Newsom.
Kevin, I want to give you the final say. Say I'm appointing you as an advisor to the governor. What would be your strongest words to him? And I guess the governor of your own state. What would be the strongest words to try and get the attention of these leaders?
These reactors that they're trying to bail out and extend the operations at are mega catastrophes waiting to happen. We already have lived on borrowed time for decades, and it's absolute suicidal insanity to be doing this. And as Harvey said, there are ready alternatives that do not entail catastrophe or the waste of billions of dollars of hard-earned taxpayer dollars.
Do you find it shocking as we say goodbye about the amount of loose talk by sort of, your typical, whatever the channel is, there seems to be, it's almost become okay to talk about the possibilities of a nuclear conflagration. It seems like a door has been opened for that dialogue and for people to think the unthinkable. Is that concern you, Kevin?
Yes, very much so. I mean, we are, you know, even the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists puts us at 100 seconds to midnight on their doomsday clock, and that was before the war between Russia and Ukraine started. So we're flirting with catastrophe of a planetary scale. So we better sober up quick and solve these problems before it's too late.
Wow. All right. Well, I really appreciate the information from both of you. Kevin Camps, Beyond Nuclear, check them out. Harvey Wasserman, as always, we appreciate the great work and also the work that you do every Monday in the election protection seminars. By the way, how do people get to those?
They can write me directly, Dennis, solartopia@gmail.com, S-O-L-A-R-T-O-P-I-A, @gmail.com. If you write me, I'll send you a PDF of the People's Spiral of U.S. History. Have quite a few takers from your great network, Dennis, so keep up the great work. The People's Spiral of U.S. History, write me directly, solartopia@gmail.com, and you can I'll link you into our Zoom call. Kevin was a real star today, and it's always great to have you on as well.
Well, thank you. Of course, it's not my network. That's the beautiful thing. It's the People's Pacifica Radio Network, and we're proud, all of us are proud to be a part of it. Thanks to both of you. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll be joined by Chip Gibbons. Chip Gibbons has a lot to say about defending rights and dissent in the context of Julian Assange. A lot going on. Stay with us. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I am delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Chip Gibbons. Gibbons is Policy Director of Defending Rights and Dissent. He's been tracking what's been going on, among other things, around Julian Assange. Chip Gibbons, welcome back to Flashpoints. It's good to have you back again.
It's always good to be on Flashpoints. I've been on a number of times to talk about Julian and the Espionage Act and so many issues that our corporate media are ignoring.
Well, let's jump right in there, because it does seem, in terms of the corporate press, the only thing they're talking about now is Trump and how he violated the Espionage Act, and now we got him dead to rights because here's the law and it's about traitors and all that kind of stuff. But you think maybe that's not the best way to go in terms of, I know you're not a Trump fan,
questions? I'm not a Trump fan at all, Dennis. And, you know, I've been working on this book about the history of the FBI, and I've been very critical of the FBI over the years. And one of the worst things that happened to me as a critic of the FBI has been Donald Trump, because everything about the FBI becomes whether you're undeniably loyal to Trump or, you know, you're going to defend them because they're the best thing that's ever happened to us. And as we were waiting for them to unseal the warrant, the other issue I work on is the Espionage Act, and I kept saying to myself, please don't let it be based on the Espionage Act. Please don't let it be based on the Espionage Act. And lo and behold, it was based on the Espionage Act. So now any conversation about reforming or repealing the Espionage Act is going to be about, you know, does this benefit or hurt Trump? And of course, if you're going to just look to benefit Trump, you're really a Trumper, you're really a this. But the biggest disservice, and I don't find Donald Trump sympathetic at all, and it's possible that even under a reformed law that would protect whistleblowers and journalists, he might still go to jail for whatever he may or may not have done. I mean, he's not a whistleblower, he's not a journalist. But, you know, people keep saying these really fantastic things on CNN and stuff that, like, you know, for them to have gotten this warrant, they'd have to have evidence he gave information to a foreign government, or people seem to think the Espionage Act means espionage. And there are parts of the Espionage Act that do, in fact, mean espionage, but none of those are the parts that were cited in the warrant. I mean, if they had evidence that he had given information to a foreign power, I know some people had speculated maybe he was given nuclear secrets to the Saudis, in which case he certainly belongs in a prison for something. But you know, they would have charged him with the provision of the law that bars giving defense information to a foreign power. Instead, they charged him, or they didn't charge him, they based the warrant under Section 793 of the Espionage Act, which has nothing to do with giving a foreign power. It has to do with obtaining national defense information, or negligently moving national defense information, or disclosing or retaining national defense information. And 793 is the provision of the Espionage Act Daniel Ellsberg was charged under. It's the provision Chelsea Manning was charged under. It's the provision Edward Snowden was charged, some other ones that Julian Assange is being extradited under. So they're literally charging him with this provision that is very broad and covers a wide range of conduct. And like I said at the beginning, maybe even if we narrowed it, we would still want to criminalize what Trump may or may not have done, and we don't really know, because that's sort of the whole thing about the Espionage Act, is that there's this huge pageantry of secrecy around it, right? You know, in order to stress how important it is to keep these secrets secret, they don't even tell the jury or the judge half the time what's going on. You know, there's been people who have been sentenced under the Espionage Act, and the judge has conceded that he didn't know what information was given, to whom it was given, or what the impact of it was, but it must be very serious. Or, you know, in the Daniel Hale case, which I covered for Jacobin, the drone whistleblower, there was a classified portion and an open portion, and I sat through the open portion, and some parts of that have been retroactively classified, right? So you don't get a transparent investigation under the Espionage Act, and treating this provision and the warrant that is a law that has nothing to do with spies, that has been used against whistleblowers, and having people go on TV and say, oh, this means they have strong evidence he was in league with a foreign power, is really damaging to those cases where the Espionage Act is being abused. I ultimately don't know what they think Donald Trump did. They're not telling us. So I can't really comment on the specifics. You know, the man's a crook, right? I mean, this is somebody who set up a fraudulent children's cancer charity. I'm not, you know, going to defend him. I'm sure they can get him for something. But I don't think we should be rehabilitating the Espionage Act, and we certainly shouldn't be propagandizing about what a serious law it is and how difficult it is to charge someone unless they're really, truly a spy under it, when we know that's point-blank false.
And it does reflect the narrow nature of reporting corporate press every time. Now, Donald Trump has got some serious problems. Rudy Giuliani was just informed that he is a target of the investigation in Georgia. Who do they want him to talk about? They've got Trump on tape saying, find me the votes. You've got the U.S. Attorney General honing in at a number of different levels, way beyond the charges of the Espionage Act. You've got the New York Attorney General and the District Attorney, and they all are ready and raring to go. It does feel like a bit of a distraction because it's a juicier story, right? It sort of appears as a more dramatic story. President of the United States engaged in espionage. But as you say, it's been a troubling law, and it's easy. It's going to be, I'm not saying he'll be able to wiggle out because everybody really wants him now. But That's not the way it should be, and you could blow this investigation if it becomes all about espionage.
Yeah, it's the juicier story so long as you don't know what the Espionage Act is, right? Former president
sells out own country. Like, yes.
Former president grossly and negligently moves national defense information from its lawful location is a lot less juicier of a story. It isn't really that interesting. He's done. There's credible evidence in Georgia and with the January 6th commission about very serious crimes against democracy. And this has been the repeated problem with how the Democrats and others have tried to go against Trump. They have these very serious offenses against democracy, and they completely ignore them to go after some sort of nonsense offense against the national security state. And I don't know if there is a there with this specific warrant, because we don't know anything about it. You know, maybe he was trying to give nuclear secrets to the Saudis, in which case, you know, stop him, right? You know, I'm in favor of that. Or maybe he took something that was overclassified and left it in a box sitting in his house, right? Either of those two things could be true under the...
Or maybe, I mean, honestly, now that you're in the region, or maybe he could be found to be giving nuclear weapons and more nuclear secrets to the Israelis, which is something that the United States has been doing for decades.
That's totally possible. I mean, we don't know.
Secret.
We don't know. Secret. Yeah, I mean, and that's... They can't tell you, because otherwise then it's not a secret worth prosecuting someone for.
Exactly. That's what it's really troubling, because it does cloud what is clearly somebody who could be held liable at all levels, from insurrection, as we said. There are so many cases. He's going to go down. Will he ever go to jail? Well, billionaires and rich people don't tend to go to jail in this country.
No.
But he's going to have a problem running again. And unless they get so narrow with their espionage and it gets so cloudy and unclear some other terrible thing happens, and once again Trump transcends and ascends. But you're also been covering Julian Assange. Now, as you said, he's being prosecuted. He's about to be extradited and being prosecuted on the espionage. He could spend the rest of his life in jail. Maybe they want to even, some would like to execute him under the espionage. I don't know if that covers it or not, but tell us what's been going on. And you've been with Roger Waters is performing, I guess, almost maybe now in your city, in D.C. Tell us about Roger Waters and Julian Assange.
Yeah, I believe Roger Waters' concert is tomorrow night. You're the second person who has suggested it is tonight. I hope that's not true, because
I read it somewhere. I read it. Somebody's got it wrong.
I'm not thinking I'm missing the concert and talking to you. But Roger Waters has been including... Roger Waters has been a very strong supporter of Julian Assange. He has been including a video of Collateral Murder in his concert. And he is performing tomorrow night in D.C. Wednesday, he's going
Thank
to
you.
Speak at a rally at 12:30 Department of Justice that was just announced this evening. I will also be speaking at the rally with Mr. Waters. So, he's been great on this issue. The big news with Assange today is that there's a new lawsuit against Mike Pompeo, the CIA, UC Global, which was a Spanish security firm, as well as the former head of it, or current head of it, David Morales. And this suit is brought not on behalf of Assange, but on behalf of four U.S. citizens, two lawyers for Julian Assange, and two journalists, both American journalists who reside abroad, who visited Julian Assange at the embassy. Obviously, the lawyers visit him because he was their client, and the journalists visited them to interview them. And what the lawsuit alleges is that when they checked into the embassy security, which was a private firm called UC Global, took their electronic devices and checked them. I know some places you can't bring a cell phone, but what they were really doing was working on behalf of the CIA and copied the contents of their phones, computers, and other electronic devices, and they're suing them for violating their Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures, because even though they were in an Ecuadorian embassy, if the CIA was doing this, they're American citizens, they still have a Fourth Amendment right. You know, it's very, very difficult to sue the CIA, even under the best of circumstances. It's very, very difficult to challenge surveillance, even when you have smoking gun evidence. But so they're going to have, I think everyone realistically knows they're going to have an uphill time at court. But I read through the brief, and I attended their press conference today, and it's a solid lawsuit. In a just court system, they would at least get to the discovery phase of their trial. And this mirrors an ongoing criminal investigation in Spain against the same Spanish conspiracy security firm, which is alleged to have illegally spied on Julian Assange, illegally spied on journalists, illegally spied on a doctor, gathered information about his patients. And Mike Pompeo has been called to testify in Spain as part of this criminal probe. Of course, I don't think the U.S. will be sending Mike Pompeo over to Spain. He'll just won't be able to vacation in Ibiza, I guess. But that was the big news today in the Assange world. And it is, you know, I'm not naive. They don't have an uphill battle, but it is very exciting to see this sort of offensive case against these sort of horrible national security bureaucrats and agencies who have, you know, wage this relentless war against WikiLeaks and Julian Assange for the last decade or so, and tortured him and spied on him and trapped him in an embassy, and are now trying to, and with this country, to be disappeared into a supermax prison.
Yeah, well, all us journalists should be very concerned, because this is a very dangerous precedent. And it is, we're out of time, but I can never get over the fact that so many major news organizations used and depended upon his work and won awards based on the work he did as an editor and a publisher, and they are lost. They don't understand. Most of them don't even understand what journalism is anymore, and they've become stenographers for government agencies. Anyway, we're going to have to leave it there. Chip Gibbons, as always, we appreciate all the good work. If people want to follow your work, what's the best way?
They can visit Defending Rights and Dissent on the web at rightsanddissent.org. They can also follow me on Twitter at ChipGibbons89.
All right. Send me a tape of that speech. You and Waters, send them both. I want to put you both back on the air. All right. Bring a recording device. Okay. Take care.
I will. All right. Have a good one. Bye.
All right, take care. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. It's your daily investigative news magazine. Well, as you know, we are covering the 3-week-plus-long, 335-mile pilgrimage by the United Foam Workers, who are marching because the governor already vetoed once their right to organize the way other unions organize. Well, Sarah Blanco and Free Will and Frank are on the road with the Flashpoints team, and they've got this for you. Listen.
Reporting on the road with the United Farm Workers for Flashpoints. Over the weekend, Sarah and I traveled to join the United Farm Workers pilgrimage from Delano, California to Sacramento, 24 days, 335 miles, to get the governor's signature on AB 2183, the California Agricultural Labor Relations Voting Choice Act. AB 2183 will put protections in place for farm workers and their right to organize and unionize, free from intimidation and retaliation. We caught up with the farm workers and their supporters as they entered a park in the city of Madera, California, after a long day of walking about 14 miles in near 100-degree temperatures. The community set up a tremendous welcome in a beautifully shaded area of the park with food, music, and dancing, and local elected officials, some with tears in their eyes, welcome the long-distance walkers as they entered the park.
Hey, hey, hey.
During the opening ceremonies, community members and local elected officials took time speaking to the crowd. This is Senator Maria Elena Durazo, representing Senate District 24. She traveled up early in the morning from Los Angeles to make the day's walk with the UFW.
Now it's a privilege to introduce a good friend, a longtime friend, and the best ally that anybody could have in Sacramento. I'd like to introduce Senator Maria Elena Durazo, a product here of the Central Valley. Maria Elena.
Buenas tardes. Good afternoon, Madera. Madera in the house. Well, I want to say first and foremost, I was born in Madera, California. So it's great to be back here, especially to be greeted by everyone here in Madera. And especially because I get to see family that I haven't seen in a while, my two primas, Cecilia and Yolanda, and where is my sobrina? Here is Severa and all of her kids. So this is about family. This is about familia. It's about our community to be treated as family, to be treated with the dignity that everybody deserves. We all worked in the fields. I worked picking cotton, grapes, peaches, you name it, olives. We did it all. And we many times did not have enough money to put food on the table or to put a roof over our head. So we lived out of our flatbed truck, or we lived, we squatted on somebody's tierra, you know, illegally, as they would say. But we did what we had to do to work. We weren't committing a crime. We were working hard. And we didn't get the respect with good wages and health care and all the other things that a hardworking person deserves. So here we are, 50, 60 years later, and my God, this is still going on in our community. No more. Let's say no more. Ya estuvo, ya basta, ya basta. What we are asking for, and what thrilled me in this march today, was people came all the entire distance, would come in their cars and give us water, give us juice, give us fruit, give us protein bars, give us Band-Aids. It was amazing to feel the love of people all over who would stop us and say, here, this is what we can do for you. We're poor, but we get to do it for you. We get to do something for you. And so I want to thank everyone along the way. But more importantly, I want to thank everybody who's doing this the entire length. And I want to thank the president of the United Farm Workers Union, Teresa. Teresa, thank you so much. Teresa Romero, incredible woman. Everybody else. And finally, we're going to make it to Sacramento. The legislators are going to vote for this bill, 2183. We're going to make sure we have the votes there. But I'll tell you, the real issue is Governor Newsom going to sign this bill? And we have to make sure to hold him accountable to working people, to Latinos, to farm workers. He has to sign that bill, 2183, right? So everybody, between now and August 26th, August 31st, which is the last day of session, everyone here should call or write or send a text. I don't care what it is. You communicate to Governor Newsom, sign AB 2183, right? Sign AB 2183. That's what we expect. That's what we deserve. And we won't accept anything less than that. He's governor today because of us. Governor today because of us. All we want is some dignity for farmworking men and women. Gracias, hermanos y hermanas.
After the festivities slowed down and everybody had a bite to eat and some rest, we caught up with some of the people that spoke on stage. As many of them spoke to the crowd in Spanish, they offered us this opportunity to get some interviews that linguistically challenged folks like myself could comprehend. This is Flashpoint's producer, Sarah Blanco, speaking with the mayor of Madera, Santos Garcia. As he spoke, it was clear he was doing his best to hold back some strong emotions.
We're in Madera, California, Saturday, August 13th, and this is Sarah Blanco reporting for Flashpoints. I'm talking with Santos Garcia, the mayor of the city of Madera. How are you feeling today watching the farm workers come into your city today?
As a former farm worker myself, we picked tomatoes and grapes, onion from Texas. We migrated to Arizona, and then from Arizona we came to California, and then we would go up to Washington State. And so they've always been deep in my heart, and I'm just glad that as a mayor I can welcome them to our city here in Madera.
Bittersweet. It's an exciting time, but it's such an enormous sacrifice to be walking over 100 miles across less than a dozen days. What does the city of Madera do, or what's next for the city of Madera in particular, to protect farm workers?
Well, we provide everything from housing to nutrition here in Madera, medical services. But to your question, why is it still fighting? Why are we still fighting? For instance, even with the Democratic governor in California, which is deep blue, we still have to fight for the rights of the farm workers to get the right to vote, to make sure that they get a living wage. And it just is so disheartening to me to see that we're still fighting. We're still fighting for this. So I'm demanding that Governor Newsom do what he said when he was running for governor, and that is protect the people that are here under his jurisdiction. Pass this bill.
So the UFW has done this march before for some basic rights, basic needs that other workers have. Shade, rest breaks, being able to use the bathroom when they need to. How important do you see the work that a farm worker does?
It's grueling work. My dad used to always say, after he stopped working in the fields, and we would go down the freeway or the road and we'd see farm workers out there in the heat of the day, he would always say, "There by the grace of God go I." It is very... I'm asking our politicians, our legislature, who's already put it on the governor's desk, to pass this bill. And all they're doing is giving them the right and the freedom to vote and not have to go in front of the patron, in front of the owner, and have to deal with voting the way they want to vote. So I want the governor to sign it and make sure that he gets it done quickly. Because these people need representation that the United Farm Workers provide, but we need the vote for them to vote for who they want to represent them.
Do any of the cities from Los Angeles up to the Central Valley get together and discuss any protections for farm workers? How hard is it, would you say, for a mayor to be able to govern or oversee what happens in their own city when farm workers are working the land?
So I've been lobbying Washington, D.C. and Sacramento for many, many years now. And so I've talked to my legislators, and they know where I'm coming from. When I'm walking in the door, they know that I'm in business. And so this bill that we're talking about, it was passed by the legislature. It's already passed. All it needs to be is signed by the governor. And so signing it will help my community, my residents for the city of Madera and the surrounding area to have better lives and have representation. That's what we're looking for.
What kind of pushback do you see from owners, growers, contractors?
Well, obviously, very few in management, let's say, or ownership, right, want to see their workers organized because they know it's gonna cost them. But we need to look at their working conditions, and we need to see how they're getting sometimes abuse in wages. Sometimes they're let go or fired, or the media comes and picks people up. And I think that with this bill, they're going to be able to get better representation throughout California to make their life a better place.
I think sometimes we shy away from the words of, like, violence. There's sexual violence, there's harassment, sexual and non, there's retaliation. And people are harvesting, caring for, picking the fruit that nourishes our bodies. And there's a lot of negative energy that doesn't need to be there that could be transformed into a peaceful. Imagine if the food that we're eating was grown in a peaceful, natural way, or at least by people whose bodies are not broken, who they already love what they do. You talk to a farm worker, so many of them love what they do. But can I even stoop for a half hour, let alone for 8 hours? Any other words you'd like to say?
Well, I'm just very happy that as mayor of the city of Madera, I was able to welcome them here to Madera, provide this space for free. They're not paying a dime. We're feeding them. We're nurturing them. And in the past, that wasn't always the case. You know, leadership in Madera and governments, they've not always been supportive. But this is where my roots are at. And that's why I went in front of the city council and asked them to pass a resolution supporting them, providing the parks and the equipment for the sound system, food. And so I'm very happy today. This has made my day.
Sí se puede. Thank you so much, Mayor Santos Garcia, Mayor of the City of Madera. Thank you for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome.
After Sarah spoke with the mayor, I caught up with City Councilwoman Elsa Mejia of District 5. The emotions were also strong with Elsa. This is what she had to say.
Hi, my name is Elsa Mejia. I represent District 5 here in the city of Madera. This is very emotional for me because I was raised by campesinos. My mother and my father were farm workers, and my dad actually is still a farm worker. I saw firsthand what it's like to watch my mom get up very early in the morning, make lunch for herself, for my dad, and for us, and then go on and have an 8-hour work day under the sun, get beat down by the sun, and just earn the very minimum, take care of us. So, you know, she's a worker, she provided childcare, and everyone knows how much a mother does, right? She's your caregiver, she's your nurse, she's your teacher, she's a farm worker for us. So I applaud Mujeres Campesinas. I myself feel very inspired by working women, and all farm workers, they deserve to be recognized. They have dignity like every other job, and to see people come out and support, that makes me feel a lot of gratitude toward the community. So I'm just very inspired. I hope that, you know, the governor can see this and support them, and that they get the same rights that we all enjoy, or a lot of other workers already enjoy.
And then what about in the long term? I'm speaking with this young gentleman over here, Rafael. He was saying that housing is kind of an issue out here, and if this is like a worker community, what are you all trying to do to make sure that people stay in their houses?
Yes, housing has long, it's a long-standing issue. It's so difficult to find a place to rent, to buy here. So we are advocating for homes to be built, for programs to make housing more available to low-income farm workers, to low-income communities, and I believe that our council, the way that it that we have moved forward, we're very much in support of having those opportunities for low-income folks.
And then lastly, before I let you go, and I've noticed a lot of people get emotional when they talk about this, right? The mayor, and then I spoke with the vice mayor, Delano. The first thing she did was start waving her hand, and she was getting emotional. Just talk about what it means to you and what you would want Americans to know, because you'd know that the farm workers or immigrants always seem to get a bad rap. We're not paying them enough. We're not taking care of them like they should be. What would you just want everybody to know, maybe if they're driving down one of these roads and they happen to see people out there and it's 105 degrees, what is it that you would just like to say to the average person out there that's like biting into that food but doesn't really have the connections like you do since you grew up out here?
It's difficult not to get emotional, but it just, you see the farm worker there, and it's hard to put yourself in their shoes if you, like you said, I have lived through it, so I know what it feels like. But that's just a visual, and beyond the farm worker alone, there are families, like, they have children at home. They have very small children. They have children of all ages. It impacts more than just them. It's all of their families. They have, all workers have dignity. Their families should also have that dignity. So think about more than what you're visually seeing. You're seeing that the sun is beating down on them, that they're tired, that they don't enjoy the same protections that a lot of workers do. But you also don't see children at home that are having to go without their parents' presence. That in the long term causes a lot of different types of other issues, right? So there are a lot of struggles beyond just the farm worker. Like you see, it's kind of like a domino effect. And I would say have some empathy, some compassion, and really respect farm workers and their families.
Definitely. We need to treat them like the essential workers they are. And they carried us through the pandemic. They carried us through these big smoky fires out there working in the heat. Okay. And so Elsa Mejia, City Council, thank you tremendously for joining us. And congratulations on this great welcoming you had for the UFW and their marchers.
Thank you.
After the festivities wrapped up, the day ended with some more music and folks went to their different places to rest for the night, before waking up early the next day to start walking at 6:30 a.m. for an 18-mile journey to the next location. To stay up to date on where the pilgrimage is heading on a turn-by-turn basis, go to ufw.org for more information. This is Free Will and Franklin and Sarah Blanco reporting on the road with United Farm Workers for Flashpoints, KPFA and KFCF. Lleva sangre de los mayas, porque en su sangre lleva sangre de Cuauhtémoc, lleva sangre de Zapata y del famoso Pancho Villa. ¡Viva la raza! El mexicano hacerse gringo no puede ni quiere. El mexicano hacerse gringo no puede ni podrá. Porque en su sangre lleva sangre chichimeca, lleva sangre del azteca, lleva sangre de los mayas. Porque en su sangre lleva sangre de Cuauhtémoc, lleva sangre de Zapata y del famoso Pancho Villa. ¡Viva la marcha!
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Special thanks to producer and engineer Rod Akil. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org.